Hallo zusammen zur allerersten richtigen Folge meines eigenen Podcasts Gleichsinn. In dieser ersten Folge habe ich mich mit Charlie McLean getroffen. Charlie ist eine englische Musikproduzentin und sie lebt seit kurzem in Hamburg. Gemeinsam mit ihrer Partnerin Violet Skies hat sie das Songwriting Camp She Writes ins Leben gerufen. Was ein Songwriting Camp überhaupt ist und wie sie auf die Idee gekommen sind und was daran so wichtig ist und so toll und wie überhaupt die Rolle der Frau in der Musikindustrie vor allen Dingen auf der Kreativseite aussieht, das habe ich alles mit ihr besprochen und das könnt ihr euch alles in dieser ersten Folge anhören. Das Interview ist auf Englisch. Charlie macht das ganz wunderbar. Ich stammel ein bisschen, es tut mir leid. Ich hoffe, ihr habt Verständnis und ein Nachsehen mit mir. Es ist ja aber nun mal die erste Aufnahme meines Podcasts und mein erstes Interview auf Englisch und da war ich natürlich ein bisschen extra aufgeregt. Und ja, Erfahrung braucht das Ganze ja auch noch und dafür sind wir auch angetreten. Also, es kann nicht alles gleich perfekt sein. Ich hoffe aber, es gefällt euch. Ihr habt Spaß beim Zuhören und ich bin schon sehr gespannt, was ihr dazu sagt und ich freue mich auf euer Feedback. Fender just released news that they found out 50% of their guitar buyers in UK and US have been female. So, Charlie, what do you think is the reason for it or why now?
I think that when, speaking from my own experience, when I was a kid growing up, I wanted to be a guitar player. That was my dream my whole childhood. I was a very shy kid. But when all the other kids when I was at kindergarten were drawing pictures of what they wanted to be when they grew up, where they would draw a fireman or a policeman or something, and I drew Brian May from Queen. That was what I wanted to be when I grew up. But I was really shy, and so for me, being a guitar player was like being watched and looked at and making lots of noise. But then when I actually started thinking seriously as I got older when I was at high school about doing it, there was not one single girl at the school that played guitar. There was no woman on the TV that played guitar. Yeah. The only woman I'd ever seen playing the guitar was Jennifer Batten, who played for Michael Jackson in the 80s. And so you kind of had this idea that guitar was something that was alien. And it's not something you're consciously aware of when you're a kid. And you're looking around going, there's no women, that means I can't do it because I'm a woman.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's not a conscious decision, but it's somehow a barrier. The thing that actually made the really big difference for girls was seeing their favourite pop star playing guitar. So Katy Perry, Ellie Goulding, people like that, who weren't playing like nicey acoustic guitar. They were standing there with like a Les Paul on stage and doing their thing and saying, I could be an acoustic girly girl playing the guitar, but I don't have to be because I'm cool and I do this. And it's not about me trying to be one of the boys. It's about me embracing being myself playing the guitar, and I happen to be a girl.
Yeah.
And taking the female aspect of it out of the equation. And I think as you had a few people doing that, then you had Taylor Swift doing that.
Yes.
And when you have people who are that big in the pop world doing it, it means that it suddenly goes from being this thing where, you know, when I joined my first band, one of my first experiences of getting on stage as a guitar player was, and I grew up in a very provincial place, some guy telling me I was shit at the guitar. I had not plugged my guitar in. So he hadn't heard me play. He didn't. It was my first time going out and playing a gig, I think, pretty much, as a guitar player.
Yeah.
And he told me I couldn't play the guitar. I'd not even tried.
Yeah.
So he was already judging that I couldn't do it. And
because you were a woman.
Because I was a girl.
Yeah.
And when you tell people as a guitar player that you're a girl, that you tell people as a female that you're a guitar player, they ask you why you're not the singer or why you're not playing the keyboards or playing one of the girl instruments. And I studied guitar at university, and by the end of it, what was I doing? I was playing keyboards all the time. Not because of the school, because the school was amazing, but within the opportunities I was getting outside of that, when I would go and audition for jobs as a guitar player, they were like, oh, we don't need a female guitar player.
Yeah.
Meaning they just needed a guitar player.
But not a female.
Yeah, and so because they weren't specifically looking for a woman, I wasn't going to get the job, which is why I stopped being a guitar player. That world is dying very fast.
Yeah, and thank God.
Thank God. It's so over time. But yeah, it's interesting to see now that it's 50% of new guitar players are female, because I think that women are, A, every bit as capable of playing the guitar. There's no physical attribute that men have that women don't have about playing guitar. It's not hard. But that's because of the tradition of what guitar means. It's about masculinity and being a rock band.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like
being brave and powerful.
Yeah, and I'm so, of course women aren't brave or powerful, are they? Oh,
of
no,
of course
never.
Not. Never. I had a similar situation. I managed a band. Mm. There were three boys and we've had this gig. And there was a technic guy coming towards us and asking, okay, so you play this instrument, this and this, okay. And then he turned to me and said, and you are going to sing? And I was like, no, I'm the management. I'm not the singer here.
I mean, I grew up with my father largely being sort of my, when I was really small, being like kind of the primary caregiver a lot of the time, because my mum was a nurse and she worked nights, so my dad worked at home.
Yeah.
So he was always around looking after me when I was really small. And they
Do
were
you have sisters or brothers?
I have an older sister as well. And both of us were brought up in, so they were, when I was a kid, they were doing up this very old house. Mm-hmm. And my dad would be building a wall or doing plumbing or electrical stuff. And so if we wanted to spend time doing something, we'd be doing DIY, we'd be building things. Those aren't girl things to do, but we did them and we were taught how to do them.
Nice.
Because that's practical. And,
of
you know,
totally.
Hats off to my father for being a good dad, because he didn't say, oh, you can't do that, you're a girl. He said, you can do this because you're a person and I need a hand, so come on. But also, you know, when my mum came home, she'd be there getting stuck in with it, and she's about 5 feet tall. She's a tiny woman, completely unstoppable. She can mix cement like nothing you've ever seen. We didn't have those like old-fashioned roles of like what women and men were supposed to do in my family. So even though
I'm quite modern, actually,
yeah, absolutely. And even though I know that that gender difference in music still had a massive impact on me, like I was saying, as a guitar player, and you know how I kind of found my way professionally as a musician, certainly in terms of the way that I viewed myself overall in the world, I was really lucky, because I was never made to feel like I was supposed to be pretty in pink or frilly or nice or something. I was supposed to be a person, and whoever that person was, that was what really mattered. That it's like, it's good to be a good person, but not to be a nice girl.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's such a fundamental difference.
So how did you find your way to music industry, except for having this dream of becoming a guitar player?
Well, I started out in classical music. I played a lot of different instruments as a kid. I had quite a short attention span, but...
Is music a topic in your family at all, or...?
Sort of. I mean, my mum sings in choirs. She's never been, like, a professional musician. My aunt is a music teacher. But there's never been any, like, professional players or anything in my family. It's just something that... On my mum's side, everybody sort of did a bit. But both my parents listened to a lot of music. There was always music on in the house. Like, my mum would listen to classical music all day, every day. My dad listened to, like, proper, like, dad rock.
Probably that's where you got the wish for the teacher.
Yeah, exactly. But he really loved, like, classic songwriters, as did my mom, and then there was always sort of Motown and soul and stuff in the house.
Yeah.
So yeah, my dad's record collection, well, my parents' record collection figured very large in my musical education.
Same with me. My mother loves ABBA and Diana Ross and all those disco funk stuff, and I'm such a pop girl. You can't imagine.
It's so educational, because it's like masterpiece songwriting, and like with the disco stuff as well, the production is incredible, the arrangements are incredible, and you're absorbing all of this stuff when you're a kid and you don't even know.
Yeah.
And I always feel really bad for anybody who didn't have parents listening to music. I was sort of imbued with like a passion for loving music, and playing music was always easy somehow for me. So it was always there, and it was kind of the only thing I really did, because I was shy. I didn't really go out much. Eventually, when I was about 15, I decided I wanted to be a professional musician. And growing up where I grew up...
Wow, that's a tough time to decide that.
Oh, yeah. No, I came home and I was doing my GCSEs, so like the exams at the end of high school.
Okay. In England?
Yeah, in England. And I came home one day and I said to my mum, I want to be a professional musician. Because, you know, she was sort of trying to encourage me because I was very academic and I was thinking about going into science and I loved physics. So that was kind of one avenue. But then there was also the idea of medicine maybe and becoming a doctor. And one day I came home and I was like, Mom, I want to be a musician. This is what I want to do with my life. And she looked me right in the eye and said, if you're going to do it, you better do it properly. But if you really want to do this, we'll support you.
Oh,
and,
nice.
You know, they never had a lot of money, but they cared so much about me getting to do what I really wanted to do that it was always that belief from my parents was always there, which was really beautiful.
Yeah.
I sort of drifted around for a while after I finished school and then got my shit together and
finally.
And then I learned to play guitar. And then I kind of lied my way into music school. I'd been playing guitar and kind of really taking it seriously. But I felt like I was sort of a little bit of an imposter because I'd only really been playing guitar for about a year when I auditioned to go to music school.
And you wanted to audition by playing guitar?
Yeah, I was going to major in guitar doing a degree. So I studied at BIM in Brighton. I did. My degree was in professional musicianship, mm-hmm. which is a degree in like how to make money out of music, but it's also a music degree kind of on the side. Mm-hmm. But it's like a real mix of the two things. But you major in an instrument discipline or in songwriting or production. When I auditioned, I really, really didn't know how to actually play the guitar. Like, because I'd come from a classical background, I could not improvise. To this day, I still am a terrible improviser. I've got symphonies going on in my head. I've got jazz bands going on in my head. I've got anything you want going on in my head. And if you sit me down in front of a computer or in front of a piece of paper and a pen, I can write you anything. But you say, get up and play a solo. And I'm like, I can't play music. I don't understand. And I don't know what it is. It's like a huge mental block. It's a strange...
I can't imagine. I mean, if you can write it on paper, you can play it, right?
Exactly. And the thing is, I can play it. It's just in that moment of like, I know, say you're at a jam night or something. Jam nights are like, I could get up and...
sing or
do anything you like. Musically, I can get in a room with anyone and produce with them, write with them, write a great pop song, write anything you like. Get me up on a jam night and I'm fucked. I can't do it. Don't know why. It's a strange thing. But anyway, yeah, so I went to music school, did that, and I was loving it, but there were two issues that I was finding. One of them was that when I would audition, like I said, I would audition for guitar jobs and they would say, we're not looking for a female guitar player, sorry. And because my name is Charlie, they would often, if there wasn't a picture, they'd think I was a guy. Then I'd turn up for the job and they'd be like, oh, sorry, we're not looking for a girl. And it's like, you hear that enough times and it's like,
get it.
This isn't really a job. And then also when I was in my final year at uni, I got really, really sick. And I had to have a lot of surgery and it meant that I couldn't play guitar for a while afterwards.
So you couldn't train?
Well, it was, I couldn't hold the guitar, because it was like major sort of internal surgery. And it meant that I couldn't go and do a gig because I couldn't stand up with the guitar for long enough.
Got it. Yeah.
And it kind of made me fall out of love with the idea of being an instrumental player because, when somebody takes that away from you, you either get so hungry, you feel like you're going to die, or else you just get really sad. And I got really sad about it. And then I looked at it afterwards, like, why do I feel really sad about the fact that I have my thing I love most in the world taken away? And it was because I realized it was no longer the thing I loved most in the world. Mm. What I really loved was music. It wasn't playing in a band. It wasn't going on the tour bus. It wasn't...
Well, who loves going on the tour bus?
Absolutely nobody with a brain, or nobody who's sane, at least. I don't know. The idea of living on a bus, like, that's like having no home. No one would choose that. But I got to the end of my degree, and I was chatting with one of the lecturers and saying, what do I do with my life? And she said, well, there's this internship going at a studio. It's with these guys, Biff Stannard and Ash Howells. And I didn't know who they were, but I did a little bit of research. And Biff Stannard produced the Spice Girls records.
Oh, my God. I would have gone crazy.
I did go crazy. I was the obsessive Spice Girls fan when I was a kid. Really? I was, you know, when everyone was picking their favourite Spice Girls, yeah. Like Scary Spice. Scary Spice is my idol in all things in life, because she's everything I want to be in the universe, because she's so cool. She was so kick-ass, and I just thought, this woman is fire. I want to have that fire in my belly. And so she was a huge inspiration to me, but they as a band were a huge inspiration to me as a kid growing up. And so the idea of working with him and with Ash Howells, who's one of the top pop mixers and engineers in the country, you know, it was like an opportunity down from heaven, except that I knew nothing about producing. I knew nothing about engineering. Wow. Okay. I knew how to plug in a microphone, and that was basically
it. And that's it. So how did you lie your way into that?
I went in with a couple of things that I'd kind of produced.
Yeah.
And by kind of produced, I mean that kind of my boyfriend at the time had sort of produced them, and I just sort of lied and said I'd done it. And then Biff's dog walked in, and I made a massive fuss out of the dog. And I think mostly I got the job because I liked their dog, and they liked me I liked the dog, and just because they liked me. And to be fair, one of the things that when I got to know them, when I've been working for them for a while, one of the things they loved was the idea of having a woman working in the studio, because neither of them had ever had the opportunity to do that. And they'd both been working in the industry for 20, 30 years already. Yeah.
And I bet it's not because they didn't want, but just because no woman applied.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I was really lucky with working with Biff and Ash, that they forced a bridge of that gap, because they employed me and they sent me out on every job they could find, everything. Even if they didn't need me, I just sat in the studio and watched and learned.
Nice,
and I was there as an engineer, as a producer, in rooms with people who had also never worked with women before, people who'd won Grammys, people who'd done all sorts of things, worked with huge artists. And then later on, I was mentored by Rupert Hine, who produced Tina Turner and billions of people. He's like one of the kind of granddaddies of innovation in popular production as well, because he was like one of the first guys using computers in music. He's a seriously important person, and I was really lucky to be mentored by him. And he'd never worked with a female producer before. He'd never worked with a female engineer. And he'd been working in the industry for 50 years. And that someone who's like Rupert, just as Biff and Ash were, huge feminist. Rupert's the biggest feminist I ever met, I think. And yet, still, he'd not managed to find anyone. So when I first started, I mean, my very first day, I came in and I was working on X Factor, so one of those like talent TV shows in the UK.
What did you do there?
I was the engineer for the backing vocals for all of the backing tracks.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there to help arrange the backing track, help arrange all of the backing vocal arrangements and record just vocals. So it was a really simple job, but I didn't actually really know how Logic worked. Logic being the program that I was using
Logic is the software.
Yeah, the software for recording the audio. So I didn't really know how that worked. And I came in, first day on the job. They handed me a box, didn't know what it was. They're like, can you just rig up this... can you just put this rig together? Rig being the thing you talk about when you're talking about like a system you use to record audio. And I had in my hands a compressor and an interface and a bunch of cables. I didn't know what a compressor did. And I'd never put this stuff together before. I had no clue. And so I was like, yeah, sure, great. I'll have it together for you in a minute. Do you need anything right now? Shall I do some tea? And they're like, no, we're busy for about 45 minutes and then we'll come through and we'll have a chat. So I knew I had 45 minutes. So I got in there. I was like, YouTube. Googling, what's a compressor? How do I put this stuff together? So it was very much a case of, oh shit, how quickly can I learn? Because I knew that if I got found out that I didn't know what I was doing, I wouldn't get to keep the job. And it's like, what the hell else am I going to do with my life right now? I just finished a degree playing an instrument I don't want to play anymore. Oh, yeah. I've just survived serious, serious illness. I am going to make something of my life right now. And it starts right now.
Yeah.
If I fuck this up, I'm never going to forgive myself. So I'm just going to learn right now. So I sat there and Googled how Logic worked. I sat there and Googled how to put all this stuff together. So then when they came in...
Thank God for Google.
I know. All praise and hail Mother Google. Because they came back in, were like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, all done, ready to go. And, you know, quietly sweating buckets, but they couldn't see. I mean, I'm sure they pretty quickly worked out that I didn't know what I was doing, but I worked so hard on that job. I was there because of the nature of the work as well, because when you're doing a TV show, you are in at the deep end. It's, you know, a lot of our days were sort of 14, 16 hour days of just tracking audio all day, every day. So if you're going to learn how to record stuff,
you do it there.
You learn it right then and there. It made me start to wake up and realize how much I knew musically as well, because I was there. I'd been taken on as an engineer not to do anything musically, and by the end of it I was arranging all the backing vocals. I wound up singing a lot of them because the woman who was like my person I was mainly working with, an amazing songwriter and singer called Emma Rowan. She was about to have a baby. And as you can imagine, because you've got really differing levels of skill within these contestants, the backing vocals are really integral to how good the vocals sound when they're actually putting it all out live. So it was like a small job that's actually a really huge part of it. And yeah, that was my first job. And it was like 12 weeks of straight work. And I expected at the end of it for them to go, well, you don't know what you're doing, so go away. And they kept me on as their intern then for another... I think they kept me on for nearly 2 years.
Okay.
And I got to do some absolutely incredible, incredible things. And I learned everything from the ground up, and they taught me everything. I was really lucky in that situation because they knew that I knew what I was doing musically, and all I really needed was some experience, and I needed a lot of confidence. And that was the thing that they taught me more than anything else. And they taught me how the business worked. They taught me what the jobs were, what an engineer does, what a producer does, because those are very vague job titles for some people.
They are, in fact. So when we're at this point, could you maybe outline from your point of view, what's an engineer doing and what's a, let's say, music producer doing?
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with engineer, because that's a little bit more specific. An engineer is tasked with the more technical side of recording music. So whatever the arrangement of the music is, whatever it sounds like, whatever the band does, it's the engineer that takes the live performance and whatever else has gone on with it, whether it's in the computer, if it's programmed or whatever. Their job is to make sure that that sounds great and is put either down to tape or to the computer, whatever, however you're doing it. Make that sound amazing, and then if they're mixing it, to mix it so it sounds like a final record. If they're a mastering engineer, they're there to make all the tracks on a record sound beautiful and just add a little extra 10% of magic. It's literally a magical job. Mastering engineers are wizards, just FYI. it's a job that's much more focused on the technical aspect. On the other side, music producers are... That's a very large umbrella. That's mostly what I do professionally. Traditionally, a music producer is an arranger of music, but not just on a level of, you know, how does the string arrangement go, for example. It's more, you can be on any level with being a music producer. where you can be the person that has a vision for a record mm-hmm. and will oversee lots of different producers arranging individual songs, and you're there as the executive producer. You're...
Like you imagine in old films having a guy sitting in the back of the studio smoking
his
cigar.
Little chair. Yeah,
and
exactly.
just like saying, okay, now do this again, and you do this, and you do this.
So you've got the person that can mm-hmm. kind of oversee a whole record. You'd call that kind of an executive producer. But a lot of the time, just a producer. They can have lots of producers under them, or they can be in charge of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. You can be hands-on with the actual arrangement of a song. This tends to be more of the modern producer and their role, because lots of producers are beat makers. So they'll be programming drums and all the other parts that go into making a modern pop song, say. There are other parts of it that have nothing to do with the music mm-hmm. itself, where you're there to... Rupert, my mentor, put it really beautifully, where he was talking about the job as a producer is to help the artist to be the best that only they can be. Mm-hmm. So it's not about making them the best of something. It's about making them the truest expression of their own artistic self, their own artistic identity, because... You can make cookie cutter records that all sound the same and make tons of money, and that's great, but so much of music production really should be about the person-to-person relationship between the artist and the producer. And stemming out of that, I swear to God, I'm probably a qualified therapist at this point. You're there to nurture the creative process and make it the best that it can be, and you're also, a lot of the time, you're sort of a bridge between... Certainly in my experience, you wind up being kind of a bridge between the business and the personal mm-hmm. sides of music, because the artist is, for the most part, especially when they're making a record, they reach a place where they're in quite a fragile state, especially if it's personal music. But even if it's not, even if it's very impersonal pop music, there'll be a moment when I think it's happened with every artist I've ever worked with at some point, if you get really into it with an artist, where... they start to question what's more important, mm-hmm. their commercial success, which obviously the business side of things, you'll always get pushed in that direction.
Of course, yeah.
Because the business has to make money, so it's in everyone's interest for you to make the most commercially viable product possible. But there will always be that moment that the artist will take a step back, and then they'll have this moment of clarity where they remember where they came from, mm-hmm. or they'll start to question what they're doing and whether it's really right for them. And the idea as a producer is that you head that whole crisis off at the path by ensuring that the artist is actually okay with making the record that they want to make. So you have to really clearly understand their motivations, both personally, career wise and looking at the big picture and making sure that they stay with their own big picture. You find out the big picture before they start, and then your job is to just make sure that that picture doesn't get screwed up by the process of actually expressing the record. And that's probably the hardest part of it, because the music is always easy, but everything else is the challenge.
So the funny thing is that it's not funny. The thing is, what you just described, for me, looking at it, sounds like pretty much female qualities mm-hmm. to be there on a very emotional side of things, dig in deep personally. That's so important for the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that one of the key things, I suppose, is that a lot of people don't really necessarily... I mean, even a lot of professional producers who are sort of coming from that kind of beat-making mm-hmm. side of things, they don't necessarily actually understand how integral this interpersonal stuff is to the job. When we think of producer, we just see the back of some guy's head sitting at some big old Neve console, and that's you Google music producer on Google, and it's just a bunch of the backs of dudes' heads.
Yes, that's true.
And it's like, that's not a job where you look at it and go, yeah, I want to be the back of that guy's head,
and I want to hang in a sticky room all day long. Yeah, true.
Yes, and drink a lot of coffee.
And beer. I was about to say beer.
See, I don't drink when I'm if I'm seriously producing. I can't do that. But I just drink coffee.
Yeah.
And then when I'm done, I drink whiskey just to make up for it.
Okay, this is so male-ish what you just said.
I know.
When I'm done, I'm drinking whiskey.
Or brandy, to be fair. I do love a good cognac, but I'm just going through a bit of a whiskey phase at the moment. It's really nice.
So, when you kind of had those, I don't know if there's a certain point where you know, okay, now I'm confident enough to go out and say, I'm a music producer, you're an artist or you're a band, yeah, sure, come to me in my studio and I can handle it. Has there been this point?
It wasn't like a light bulb going off in my head. It was a really slow process. I had an artist that I was working with for about 3 years who was, I started out as his cello player and then eventually was in his band full time, and then I produced him, and it was because of that whole thing, because his publisher was Rupert, my mentor. Hi. And it was Rupert that sort of said to me, you know, you're already a producer. And I was like, am I?
Really?
Oh. And it was actually somebody else saying to me that I was a producer, and somebody like Rupert saying that I was a producer that kind of clicked me into the fact that actually I really was.
I might be, yeah.
But I'd sort of been messing around with producing things, but really I'd just been engineering up to that point. But we did, with that artist, we made a bunch of records together, and they did pretty well, and it was kind of an ongoing thing, but because I was very sort of wrapped up in that project, I wasn't reaching out and being as ambitious as I should have been. And it was sort of, somehow I was using, it wasn't that I was using that project to mask my lack of confidence. It was more that I was allowing that in myself to, I knew I could make a good record because all his records were really good. But I wasn't pushing myself out there and going, hey, I can do this for everyone. Because somehow I felt like I still wasn't ready. And it's something that I have come across with so many female producers where they always think they're not ready. So, for example, a friend of mine, this amazing, amazing producer from Finland, whose name is Minna Koivisto, she is one of the best producers I've ever met.
And I've met her too, I can...
Yeah, and...
I can say it too.
She's so ridiculously talented. Nobody knows who she is really outside of Finland at the moment, but they will because she's insane. But she's incredibly successful over in Finland. But when I first met her, the thing that blew me away was that she was sort of talking about herself like she wasn't ready to sort of leave the kind of comfort of Finland, where she knew she was big, but she was like a big fish in a small pond and it was sort of safe. And I there was this like lack of, because it wasn't lack of confidence, because she's very confident in her abilities, but it was a lack of self-belief that other people would see in her ability.
Yeah. Do you think that's a female thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 100%. I've never noticed with guys that they have that. All people have that. But men grow up as boys and as young men, they grow up fighting that out of one another because they're all competing with one another.
Yeah, true.
And because of the nature, I think, as well, specifically of, say, music production or music in general, because you've got, say with producers, you've got a bunch of guys, three of them make beats. Those three guys are going to hang out and make beats and be like, hey, let me show you this thing I did. Let me show you this thing. And they're all trying to outdo each other. They're all showing each other stuff. The female producers, they never met another female producer. Yeah. And you can't, as a girl, go and invade boys' time because the boys don't want you to invade boys' time because it's boys' time. So you're on your own all the time.
Yeah.
And when you know you're part of a minority, and then you're on your own with that thought that I'm part of a minority, I'm part of a minority, nothing ever validates your own self-belief that you, when you get out of your little shell that you're in, people will take you as seriously as you know deep down they could and should. You know somewhere in your core, underneath whatever layers of bullshit you're convincing yourself about how you need to be able to play 12 instruments and engineer and master and do everything in order to make someone a bloody drum beat, which is something that you find with female producers. They're all multi-skilled. there's two sides to it. One side is the fact that women themselves are often, and I don't think it's just women, whenever you are the minority in a situation, you will tend to be your own worst enemy because you feel, often rightly so, mm-hmm. like you have to justify your own existence yeah. in that field yeah. because totally. You will be looked at as like the other, the different one, and you'll be scrutinized, you'll be looked at much mm-hmm. more carefully than the guy who blends in with all the other guys, because they'll be like, oh, it's just a guy, you know, I heard one of his beats, it was cool, he must be good.
Yeah.
Whereas, so for example, I worked for LA, I worked in LA for the first time recently, and my A&R out there said it was the first time she had ever been asked exactly what somebody did mm-hmm. on the demos that they that she was pitching them for.
Yeah.
Whereas when she pitches for guys, it's just like, okay, cool, those are the guys'
yeah.
demos.
Yeah.
For me, it was that's like, it. So what did she do on these? She wrote and produced everything. Yeah, but what did she do?
Yeah, she wrote and produced.
But what did she do? And it's like, you have to, the fact that those questions yeah. get asked yeah. over and over and over again, yeah. it says that it's not just something that's going on in a woman's head or in, you know, if you broaden it out past women in music, it's in every walk of yeah. life when you're the minority that people are questioning your right to be in the room. And that in itself, because you know that that stuff is there, that then undermines people's confidence as well. So there's no smoke without fire in the end is what I'm trying to say. There is, it's not even necessarily about sexism. It's about almost like it's about fear of the other. And mm-hmm. It's not something specifically gender, I don't think. But still,
yeah.
there's this idea that there are certain times when it's okay for a woman to be around and certain times when it's not.
Yeah.
There's certain times when it's okay for a woman to speak and certain times when it's not. Men do what they want and women know their place. And that's where it's like, wow, it's the 1950s all over again.
Yeah.
What the hell are we doing?
Yeah.
And those people are thankfully pretty few and far between.
Yeah. And it's the same on the business side, actually. Mm. It's also, there are women working on the business side.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of women working in promotion mm-hmm. Parts or marketing of music labels. There are a lot of women working in sync
mm-hmm.
departments.
Yeah. And music supervisors as well.
But that's really the most female-ish
mm-hmm.
it can get within the music industry, because when you work on the management side, it's quite... you're quite a lonely rider.
Mm-hmm.
There are women... But mostly, most of the time, being a kind of assistant.
Yeah, you're kind of the help more than the boss.
Yeah, but when you are kind of the boss, then it gets difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Then I often had the situation that people came and told me that they really like it, that I'm doing this. And I was like, yeah, and why the hell not? Yeah. And why do you have the feeling that you need to tell me?
Yeah.
And why do we talk about that?
Being congratulated for doing your job is a bit of a strange thing, because no one's congratulating the guy next to you because he's just there doing his job.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
Actually, I have a way to react to that.
Mm.
But when I go home, that's in my head. And there have also been situations where I had to be the tough negotiator, where afterwards I was told that I gave the impression of being bitchy. And I thought that through the situation, and I came to the conclusion that one of my bosses would have said exactly the same thing
mm-hmm.
and would meant nothing. But for me, it's like, you have been bitchy.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Because you're not a team.
I did nothing.
Yeah.
I've been tough, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I would have been a man, I would have been congratulated for...
Yeah.
succeed in the negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm bitchy.
Yeah.
That's of course not always the case, but it happens.
And this is whether it's a nurture or nature thing, I don't know, but it's where men really struggle with women not being subordinate to them. Men really struggle with women in positions of authority because mm-hmm. they feel either like they're being undermined as men or like they're being told off by their mother. And if they're being told off by their mother, they're being told they did something wrong. And it's like, if you're in a negotiation with somebody, it's not that they did something that's fundamentally wrong, it's that you're disagreeing with them and they can't differentiate between the two situations. And that is very, I think that's a very frustrating thing that I feel like every woman on earth has to, we're all dodging that bullet every day of trying to like politically maneuver everything we do, everything we say, every sentence that we choose to utter is trying to avoid that, like, am I a bitch or am I too fluffy or am I a bitch or am I too fluffy? Like, where's the line where you're just a professional?
One thing I really like about working for and with a lot of men, that this kind of bitchy moments that everyone has are no problem there.
Yeah.
They are forgotten the next 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. Whereas between women, sometimes...
it gets personal.
It gets personal. Yeah. That's something I'm kind of sad about. Because I think if that wouldn't be the case, women had the chance to connect and network much better. If they wouldn't be so personal.
But I think there's a part of that comes from women's need to protect themselves, which they do naturally anyway. Or maybe that's a, maybe that's just an inbuilt psychological thing. But I think also, say you have an argument with someone. Like, for me, because I'm like a piece of wood. I'm like, I just don't get affected by... if someone can shower right in my face, and I'm like, okay, cool, you're going to be fine in a minute, so I'm going to go make some tea. And then I'll get some biscuits, and then we're going to be chill, and we're going to have a chat, because...
that sounds so English, right?
I know, it's so English.
Tea and biscuits, wow.
Well, that's the answer to anything. There's, you know, there's war on, I'll put the kettle on. Done. Donald Trump's president, I'll put the kettle on. Exactly. It solves a lot of problems. But yeah, I like, for me, I've always found that it's really easy to deal with things like that. But I feel like with women, it's like the biggest challenge that they have is to have the bravery to actually challenge the stereotype that you have to take everything really personally. And it's like, you can still be really emotional about something, but you can stop shouting at each other or stop being upset about something and like talking about it's the easiest way. And I think that's the thing where women need to work on themselves, but also have the bravery to, you know, take a, it's, you know, we all tell men to get in touch with their feminine side, but we don't necessarily get in touch with our other side as well, which is maybe not to put being super emotional about everything first. And sometimes just to be like a little bit, like just have a bit of an overview about stuff isn't a bad thing. That's the thing I always try and say when I'm sort of mentoring people or talking to people who are doing the same job as me and they ask me for advice. The most important thing you can do is just be yourself, be comfortable with being yourself, and don't expect everyone to like you or approve of you.
So talking about you as a mentor, you invented a songwriting camp just for women.
Yes. So I am the co-founder of a non-profit called Bitch Please, which I run with Violet Skies, who's an artist and songwriter from the UK. And we had made a record together with another producer, a guy, he's a boy, amazing dude called Felix Ducek, in Berlin, and we got together at the end of it. We wrapped the record, and then Violet and I were sitting there, and she was reflecting on the fact that she'd never been able to feel comfortable enough when she was cutting a vocal, for example, to be able to cry while she did it. And this record was really personal, really emotional for her. And we were sitting there in my house cutting the vocal, and she was sitting there, you know, surrounded by fairy lights, you know, in the half light. It was all very lovely. And you know, she was able to cry down the microphone, and my response was to tell her it was beautiful and would she like a cup of tea? Because, you know,
tea solves problems.
Because, you know, hurrah for England. We were saying that we were talking about the fact that, you know, part of that was the fact that it was women together, and that every time I worked with a female artist, they all said the same thing, that it was such a different and unique experience to be able to create with another woman without any dudes there. And it was nothing against Felix or any other dude because they did great work, but it was just having that, you know, having the difference of feeling the difference was really important. And so we hit upon the idea of running an all-female writing camp because there are professional songwriters, professional producers, and you know, we were very certain that it was really important to be able to spread this whole experience for people other than just ourselves and people just randomly finding each other in the way that we had done. And we were also sick to the back teeth of mm-hmm. this whole narrative that there's no female songwriters, there's no female this, isn't it?
Which is just a lie.
Yeah, it's just, yeah, sure, there are 2% of producers are female, but that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of them. It just means that they're not really all in one place. And the only way to disarm the argument that, oh, we don't have any women on our books because we couldn't find any, we don't have any women on working at this studio because we couldn't find any, blah, blah, blah. The only way to do that is to collect all these women together, get them doing what they do best, which is writing amazing music, and then getting people to come and look at them and go, oh, there they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Get them to network.
Exactly, so that they know each other, so that they can find each other and always have the opportunity for that experience. Mm-hmm. The industry knows who they are, where they are, why they do what they do, and how good they are at what they do. But also, and this was the other side of it, this was the mentoring side of it, was that so many of them always felt like either they kind of felt like imposters or just that they never felt truly professionally comfortable, even if they've been doing it for years. Mm-hmm. And when you give women the opportunity to work outside of that environment where they are the tiny little minnow in the pond of sharks, which is what a lot of them were feeling like, mm-hmm. you disarm that whole argument for them as well, because they know what it's like to just be a producer. They're not a female producer. They know what it's like to be an artist or a writer, not a female something.
Artist or writer. Yeah, exactly.
And so, yeah, it allowed them to redefine themselves. So we ran our first camp last year in London, funded by PRS. And from there it's snowballed, and we've done the whole thing as a non-profit organisation by bringing in sponsors to have mm-hmm. them support us by funding and supplying anything else that we need for the camps. Mm-hmm. We've been really lucky with our sponsors because we've got two of the biggest DAW, so DAW being the software that you mm-hmm. make music in. We've got two of the biggest manufacturers of that kind mm-hmm. of software, which is kind of the most important tools for producers, that being Ableton and Steinberg. Mm-hmm. Steinberg make Cubase, and both of them are passionate about trying to improve the statistics that they have within their own user base to make sure that there are actually women being represented using their software. So for them, it was like a no-brainer. And we've also had a lot of other manufacturers of instruments and all this kind of stuff coming on board to support everything. And then for the last camp in LA, we were able to partner with YouTube for that, which has kind of brought things into like next level kind of stuff.
Do you have the feeling it's since Me Too, you get more sponsors or more people having interest in showing, okay, we're also interested in women.
I think that, to be frank, yes. I think that without the Me Too movement having happened, this whole thing wouldn't have grown in the way that it has done, because there's a real pressure on everybody to consciously acknowledge, A, that there's a problem, and B, that they can be part of the solution. So to an extent, there will be virtue signaling on all levels, but mm-hmm. that's not a bad thing because in the end, the job gets done. And I really do believe that everyone that we're working with is doing it for the right reasons because they understand why, they understand the necessity of it, and they're excited to be a part of it.
Which is nice and the best thing.
Absolutely. And we're really, really... we're honoured by the level of support that we've received from so many people. Because it's just the two of us, you know, really. This whole thing, we've had help from different sources, but at its core, it's Violet and I doing this whole thing for no money. It's a huge, huge commitment that we're making, not for ourselves, but for the music industry and for all the people in it. And so to look around and see that, you know, when we started this, it was prior to the Me Too thing happening. Mm-hmm. it wasn't the thing that drove us to do it in the first place, but because everyone has started fighting the same fight at the same time, because everyone has really had enough, it's allowed us to move this thing forward and make it bigger than we ever thought was possible.
So within the past year, you've done several She Whites camps now. Mm-hmm. You've been to London, to Berlin, and to LA latest. Yep. I think Stockholm is about to happen next.
Yep.
Nice.
Next week.
So just to explain shortly what happens at a songwriting camp for mm-hmm. everyone who doesn't know that, you have several studio rooms.
Yes. For the most part, that we always aim to have a producer, top liner, and artist in the room. The top liner being the person that writes the melody and lyrics. Now, everybody will tend to move a little around a little bit in that role, mm-hmm. in their roles. So the producer will be creating the tracks, so the music side of it. Mm-hmm. But they might have ideas for the top line, so the lyrics and the melody. The artist might be a songwriter as well, and they might also be working on the lyrics and melody. And then they both the top liner and artist might have ideas for the production, mm-hmm. so the way that they want the track to sound overall. We also sometimes work to brief, or just letting people kind of just do whatever they like. One of the things that we aim for with the writing camps for everyone who's on the camp is to ensure that they have the opportunity to just do what feels right in the room, because most of the people that work together, when they get in the studio, it's the first time they've ever even met. What we do with our camps is that everybody works with different people every day, so you're broadening your network each mm-hmm. time you're writing with new people, but it's all within a closed environment, so everyone has the opportunity to meet everybody outside of the sessions.
At lunch, for instance, yeah, or so, dinner.
Yeah, and whenever we can, we like to do listening sessions of everything that's written, just the totally rough demos mm-hmm. that come out at the end of the day. So we just get a bunch of beers in, everybody gets in one big room, and we just listen to all the songs, vibe out and enjoy each other's work without judgment. Because I think it's one of the things that is really important with the She Writes camps that we do, is that it has to be a safe space. And creating a safe space for everyone to listen and share the music helps to get rid of that issue.
And you put this as a special point because you have the feeling that in male occasions it's not.
Because there is, as we were talking about earlier, there's a judgment placed on anybody who is a minority and doing a job where they're going to be scrutinized more carefully. Mm-hmm. So if you're the only female producer in the room, you know people, a certain proportion of the people in the room are going to be judging your work more harshly because you're a woman. And you are always, even if you're in the lucky position where no one's actually doing that, because you're used to it being the case, it's kind of a given that you're going to be feeling like you're more judged. Mm-hmm. So if you can provide the opportunity for people, you take that whole issue away, then you're allowing people to feel more comfortable with their own work. Yeah. And at the same time, just appreciating the creative experience that you're in the middle of. Yeah. And just enjoying great music, because one of the things that comes out of these camps that's incredible is the quality of the music. It is, I mean, I do quite a lot of writing camps as a producer and top liner, and the quality that we have found from the She Writes camps of the actual songwriting and the production is head and shoulders above any other camp, because people hold themselves to such high standards.
Mm-hmm.
Women specifically, they hold themselves to such high standards that they won't settle for anything that's not absolutely incredible. So, you know that when everybody goes home from these camps, at the end of every day, they're staying up till 3 a.m. to finish their mix to make sure it's perfect and beautiful. So when you then get the big listening party at the end where all the industry people turn up, everything sounds amazing. When we did the camp at YouTube Space in LA mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago, Leo Cohen, who's the head of YouTube Music, mm-hmm. he was there. And when it got to the actual point where we were showing all the music, he sat front and center in the middle of everything. Well, you know, most people were kind of milling around and talking and, you know, networking, as people do at industry parties. He sat there front and center, didn't talk to anyone, and just listened to every single song from the camp. And that's the level that everybody's expecting to be working on. They want everything to be perfect for that one person who wants to listen to every single song. Because they're only willing to show their best. And there's no compromise because they know that there's no room for compromise with their reputations. It's a beautiful experience. It really is. And also just, and not that I want to sound like too much of a hippie because I'm not one, but there's something beautiful about that many women in a space because it's such a kind and nurturing and fun environment. Somehow when women are together, they don't have that need to say, I'm the best. And it's also because no one can define the best song.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all subjective. So I think that kind of helps, but also we ensure that everybody understands when they want to come onto one of the camps. We make sure that they understand that the whole purpose of it
mm-hmm.
is to be like a happy environment. And that everyone has the right to feel really comfortable, and we want them to feel comfortable. We want them to feel creatively free to do whatever the hell they like.
Yeah.
And I think that in itself really helps. And it's just, you know, we pick our people carefully as well. We know, we'll always be talking to A&Rs and managers and working out who should be working with who. So if you've got, you know, people who have like super dominant personalities, we're not going to put them in a room with someone who's super shy, who's going to feel really uncomfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to put two people in a room if they're going to be butting heads all day. You know, there's a real art to the A&R side of putting one of these camps on. And I think it's the same with every camp. It's just because of the fact that what we do is so unique, we spend a lot of time doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And we gather kind of all of our intel beforehand so that we can make really, really well-informed judgments on who's going to work well with who. And that in itself creates the environment where then everyone feels like they're friends. And, you know, also, you know, women talk is one of the things. You know, women chat a lot. If I'm in an all-female session, we will work really quickly when we get round to working, but we'll definitely spend at least 2 hours drinking coffee and having a chat. This is what girls do. Yeah. But it's nice because I think actually better music comes out of it because people get to know each other better.
Yeah, totally.
I think that that's one of the biggest things is people feel more comfortable because they have the opportunity to get to know each other.
Yeah. Thinking in the direction of the future, you've had several camps now. Of course, you can go on having camps in every city of the world where there is a music industry. Because if I got you right, you've chosen the cities wisely because of
the we're hitting all of the key cities really to ensure we're reaching as many people as possible. I mean, you know, if we had the manpower to do a She Writes camp in every city in the world every month, we would do. But you know, we need to eat and sleep at the same time, and we also have our own full-time careers to run at the same time. So it is difficult because we get so many applications every day for people being wanting to be on these camps, and it's like we can't run enough to accommodate them, which is a shame.
It's an interesting development because there they are.
Yes.
All the women feeling empowered by you.
Exactly.
Maybe.
Exactly. And you know, we're finding now people are finding us who are fans, and people are talking to other people, and they found us on social media, and they're finding it really inspiring. And you know, people who were songwriters are now getting into production. There are, you know, younger, and this is one of the things that we were really, really hoping was going to happen that we're now finding is happening, is that young girls are getting in touch saying, I found you on Instagram, I think this is awesome, I just bought, you know, X, Y, and Z, and I'm going to start making beats, I'm going to start writing songs, I'm going to start singing and doing an artist project because I believe I can, and I don't care that I'm a girl.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is what we did it for.
Exactly.
And it is the most, I mean, it's like, it's really overwhelming, to be honest.
Yep. So, looking in the future, what do you think can be a possibility to now keep the good work on?
I think that it's about there being more exposure for female professionals in writing and studio work in general, so production and engineering especially, because that's the thing that's really underrepresented, is the tech side of this stuff. Having professional exposure for them, which means that, you know, we want to see there be a woman who wins the Producer of the Year Grammy. That's never happened, ever.
Yeah.
Like, no woman has ever won. There have been, like, I don't know, 10 women who have ever even been nominated, you know, out of the 60-odd years it's been happening. Mm. We want to see a point where we don't need to run She Writes camps anymore.
Yeah.
Where She Writes becomes irrelevant because it's just we write, you know. But I think that there's so many different things that we can do. We've got plans over the next year, 2 years, 5 years for the things that we want to do with the Bitch Please brand, which is kind of the overarching project for all of this outside of the She Writes camps, that will involve a lot more social media to kind of take up the mentorship mm-hmm. banner
mm-hmm.
Of what we're doing for the younger audience and for the up-and-coming people and for people to find more information. I think that there's so much mystery about the music industry, and I think that
it is, yeah, that's true.
You know, when it comes to something as simple as, like, I'm a producer, what am I supposed to charge?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That nobody knows what they're supposed to get paid as a producer. And women, we all know, it's just a general statistic, women will always undercharge
mm-hmm.
because they're always worried about being told no. Men don't do that. That's no. It's why men get paid more than women for doing the same job. It's usually because they'll go into the interview and say, I want this much, and a woman will go, how much can I have? And that's just a societal thing. That's just a fact of life. So if you don't know what you're going to charge in the first place, it means that women are undervaluing themselves when they first start. That's just one example. There are a billion questions to be answered. There are also so many amazing female creatives who can be spotlighted and showcased through social media channels. So that's one of the things that we're going to do, is start that up properly. But as a sort of an additional part of this whole thing, as it's all growing and we're getting, you know, our PR spotlight is being shone on us more, the industry is starting to come to us as mm-hmm. a sort of broker for female talent. So that's kind of the next step, is that we essentially become sort of a voice for all this amazing talent that we're finding through the camps, is we know where it all is. So when people say, instead of saying, oh, I didn't get a woman because I didn't know one, then they come to us. They were like, I don't know a woman, I'll go ask the women who know where all the women are.
Yeah.
And that's basically what's happening already. So there will be various different arms of Bitch Please popping up everywhere that will become essentially the voice of women in the music industry, where they need to find each other, where they want to find each other, where they want to grow a network so that they can be found. That's our next aim, is to facilitate that on all levels, publishing, mm-hmm. label management, you know, through working with different companies, and also bringing in all of the people that we've collected as sponsors, is bringing them in and helping them to nurture the female focused aspect of their brand. So for example, I'm working a lot with Steinberg at the moment, because when they came on board as a sponsor, they realized that only 7%, I think it was 7%, of their user base was female.
Mm-hmm.
And they were rather alarmed by this, to say the least. So I'm working with them to sort of, you know,
which is nice, because a lot of brands don't even question that.
Exactly. And I think that we're in a day and age where everyone, when they realise the statistics, they do go, oh, this is weird. I think people have realised now that when you have a disparity in your demographic, it is weird. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that everything's got to be 50-50.
No.
But it just, you know, it's about giving brands the opportunity to learn from women who do the jobs that they're trying to facilitate with the things that they do, how to reach people.
Yeah, and well, at least the idea that 7 is not...
And that's the thing, they're just missing out on a huge... Essentially, there's just a huge pot of money that's waiting to be collected from all of those guys who are... I mean, even just people who do it for fun. For all those dudes who buy a copy of Ableton or whatever product, or, you know, whatever bit of hardware, just to do it for fun, and those women who say, I can't do that, I'm a girl, if you can encourage them, they're going to buy your products, so then you make a ton of money out of it. I mean, it's just this basic capitalism, but it's also doing the right thing. So there's everybody wins, ultimately. You know, I think, I mean, like, one of my biggest influences in terms of women in music was Linda Perry. Mm-hmm. I learned to singing along to Four Non Blondes. And so I had a big, great big gritty, shouty voice. And I knew that she wrote songs because she wrote like Beautiful on the Stripped record. And she, you know, she's written huge pop hits. But she's also a producer.
Yeah.
An engineer. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that at all for years. And she is a very, very powerful, dominant voice in this whole world. And she's been screaming this from the heavens for years, yeah, saying, yeah, where are all the women? Get in the studio. And I think if we have the opportunity with all of this stuff to do like a tiny little bit, and it's obviously it's not a tiny little bit, it's a huge chunk. It just always feels like a tiny little bit somehow, and I don't know why. But if we can do something to carry on pushing that fight that women like her have been having to scream about because no one was listening and because there was no movement for them to catch mm-hmm. hold of mm-hmm. at the time and everyone was pushing back against them, we've been very privileged because we're in the situation we're in now. And if we can carry on the good fight, taking what they're doing and supporting these powerful women doing what they're doing, but also being able to do what we do in addition to that, I feel like we can really make a fundamental difference and we really can make a change permanently. And also, one thing to add to this, because it's not just about the girls, it's about boys having the opportunity to not think about themselves as men doing men things.
True.
That's yeah. also really important because so many men feel so restricted by masculinity as a, like this like really trapping concept. And if women have the opportunity to do things that should be for men, then men have the opportunity to do things, think things, feel things that should be for women, quote unquote.
Yeah.
It's better for everybody. It doesn't mean that men can't be big, burly firefighters or whatever it is. And that's the thing. It's about everybody having role models and the freedom to choose. That's the way of the future. And that only happens if we fight for ourselves and fight for everyone else at the same time. But then we really can make a difference.